I think we'll get started for those out there in the hallway. I'll pray and we'll get going. Father in heaven, we thank you for another Lord's Day, a beautiful Sunday. We're thankful for all that have come early for Sunday school. I pray that you would bless this time, bless us as we try to think through history and apply it to today. And I pray that as we study history, that it will be able to understand it and analyze it in light of your word. And I pray that you would just help us in that task. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right, so final chapter. And this is like the, this final chapter is almost like the what do they call it? The soup where you just pour everything in the pot and, you know, it's like the end of everything. You just throw it all in at the end. So basically this is, like I said, it's as we've been going, the time periods have been getting smaller and smaller. And now we're ending with a 30-year period, and it's just called conservatism and liberalism. So, and there's a lot to do in this chapter. Even with the size of the chapter, the topics are very broad. So I think, I always say what I want to do and then I don't do it. But ideally, I think talking about this chapter in sort of broad terms would be better than trying to get into too many details. Not least because a lot of us lived through some of this stuff, and so we were kind of a lot more familiar with it than, say, you know, transcendentalism and Puritanism. But so let's start with the 50s. And Singer brings up the fact that in the 50s you had a resurgence of conservatism and evangelicalism. Especially in the rise of evangelists. And so TV, radio, the TV had just become popularized. It was in everybody's, starting to be in everybody's home. Radios were in everybody's home. So you have the rise of the televangelists and the radio evangelists, guys like Billy Graham and what was the guy that started Fuller Seminary? Is it Charles Fuller or? His son was Daniel, but I can't remember his name. But so this, we talked a little bit about this last week, but this evangelism, though, is not like it's, even though it's a resurgence of conservatism, it's not like Puritanism, you know. So even though they sort of are labeled in the same camp, what we were getting starting in the 50s is completely different than Puritanism. So this is marked by profession of faith, simply, you know, to the neglect of all the other aspects of salvation. So like discipleship, church membership, the sacraments, those things become sort of put off to the side. What really matters is your saying the sinner's prayer, getting a moment of conversion, an individual, you know, turning to God. And there, you know, a lot of people that, I mean, this period of time is marked by many conversions. You know, people go to crusades and they come forward and they make a profession of faith. The problem we see, though, is that these people do not get plugged into churches all the time. They do not carry on with the discipleship. Is simply a, yes, I was saved at a crusade and then I went back to my life the way it was, or maybe some things changed, but you don't see a complete change in the culture. In fact, the 1950s, you know, you look at the TV and you think of shows like Happy Days and you know, and what's the Andy Griffith show, and sort of that, those time periods back then. And you know, it has this sort of air of, you know, the golden era, the way things used to be. But the fact is that the national policy, you know, the America did not change much because of this evangelistic zeal. Lots of people had conversions, but politically not much changed. Now there is an aspect of this is where you start to get associations with. So you have conservative. If you're evangelical and you're conservative in your theology, then you're going to line up with the conservative politics. And of course, during that time, then because of all this evangelistic zeal, you have a conservative resurgence in the political realm, but it's a conservative resurgence. And we'll get to that in just a little bit. But, you know, so we're coming out of the era of Roosevelt and Truman, and we're going to have a little bit, you know, maybe 10 years of a conservative resurgence. But, and it's very similar. These things are cyclical. It's very much like the 20s. It'll be very much, in a way, like the 80s, you know. And so you can look back in time and you see sort of these ebbs and flows. And when I say it's cyclical, it is cyclical, but it's not staying in one spot cyclical. It's a moving to the left or to your left. I'll go this way. It is a cyclical pattern, but it's moving leftward. So your conservative resurgence in the 80s is not like the 50s, and it's not like the 20s, and it's not like before. You know, it really is moving in a leftward direction. So, so even your presidents at this time, remember I said Roosevelt sort of connected with the social gospel, but the conservative values the president started adopting. Eisenhower adopted a evangelical. He's the first president to be converted in office. He was baptized. So he became converted in office, you know, and that was a big win for the conservatives. And then, of course, but, you know, there's a pattern going on to where some of us remember Jimmy Carter, who was very much a outspoken evangelical Christian whose policies were extremely liberal and leftist. So just identifying yourself with conservative evangelicalism did not mean that your policies were going to be conservative. Let's see here. So in 1950, remember we've talked a lot about the Federal Council of Churches. Well, they doubled down on, the liberals kind of saw what happened, and they kind of, this is not our time, but we need to make a plan. So they take a step back. There's a conservative resurgence. The Federal Council of Churches sort of disbands, but they restart with the National Council of Churches. And so they double down on their ecumenism and their social ecumenism. They had self-diagnosed the problem. They realized that they had failed in their mission. And so they realized that the biggest problem was American individualism, and it was a problem in their own ranks. So they decided to disband, rejoin with other forces, create the National Council of Churches, and begin not in the culture yet, but in their own. So they took about 5 years and just worked on themselves and basically tried to rid themselves of this American individualism, especially in terms of theology. And there is a sense where that's good. I mean, they saw sort of the conservative resurgence, and they did recognize that sort of this individualism of Christianity was not a good thing. Of course, their solution was not the church so much. You know, it was not true community. It was a secularized community. And so they sort of gathered their ranks, came up with a game plan, and in the late 50s, restarted their mission again and was a lot more successful this time. Their avowed objective was the realization of the kingdom of God through the strengthened proclamation of the social gospel. If America was to become truly Christian, it must first become socialistic and collectivistic. So again, this is in the 50s. Russia is starting to, you know, Russia is now a communist nation, and the National Council of Churches is looking to Russia as this sort of ideal of what we want to be like. So the emergence of communist Soviet Union after World War II as a dominant force in Europe was a cause of concern for most conservatives. So they were looking across the Atlantic and seeing everything that was happening. They're getting worried here. And in fact, many liberals thought the same thing. It was so blatant. But there were still many who believed in the ideals of communism while being suspicious of Stalin. A growing number, though, despite numerous proofs to the contrary, believed communism would change the world for the better. Despite already, I think it was 1949, you have the Berlin blockade, and now you have the civil war in China, and communist China is taking over. And, you know, in America, liberals are looking at that and saying, okay, they're not really going about it the right way, but the ideals are good. And in fact, in communist China, when they overturned basically what was a nationalistic government that was very corrupt, it was sort of communism defeated this evil thing here, so communism is good. We need to get behind the support of Soviet Russia and Red China. You know, Mao Zedong he's doing a good thing. Of course, people, you know, they do that with all, you know, Castro, you know, what he did was good, you know, people don't say that about Stalin anymore. You know, they see the evil that has been done, and of course, they wouldn't say that about Mao Zedong now, but back then they did. And they wanted to get behind it. And really, there was a slight push towards support of communism until North Korea invaded South Korea and we went into the Korean War. And because of the conservative sort of resurgence at the time and the fact now that Truman is actually going against communists, the pro-communists in America had to really take a step back at this point. And so you don't see a whole lot of push for communism, for socialism at this point. There really was during the Korean War. It was pretty tampered down. It was a wake up call to many liberals. I mean, the evil, you just can't ignore it. I mean, you know, you have the Civil War, you have North Korea invading South Korea. Eventually, you have Russia. You know, it's funny. The liberals said this. The National Council of Churches, what they said was they sort of took a step back and got a little quieter, but they said, listen, we need to set the example for Russia. So we need to find common ground. They did kind of say we can't be like Stalin. We can't – that type of communism we can't do. But if we set the example, they said, you know, Russia would follow in our footsteps, which is kind of hilarious. But almost immediately, they put out this, from a gathering, the National Council of Churches put out this statement that said America should set the tone in the way that they pursue collectivism, and that Russia would follow suit, and then Russia invaded Hungary, you know, and then it was sort of like, oh well, you know, then they couldn't even, you know, at that point they were just like, okay, we're going to just shut up for a little bit. And, but really by 1958, so Russia invaded Hungary in 1956, and at that point it was pretty clear that this is an evil regime. 1958, though the National Council of Churches is back basically saying again that this is just a radical form of communism and that we cannot stop pursuing peace with Russia because the next generation of Russians will get better. You know, it's like these people are radical, but they'll grow up. They'll get better as they go along. So this is the kind of nonsense that was going on at the time. But let's talk about the conservatism of the 50s. Eisenhower's election in 1952 allowed the conservatives to regain control of the White House. But it was a very pragmatic conservatism. Really, at stake was simply just control of the White House. There was no conservative or Christian philosophical foundation for what the Eisenhower administration was doing. In fact, you know, it's interesting. This is where you really get what we deal with now. In the Eisenhower administration, you get this sort of separation between social conservatism and economic conservatism. And a lot of people considered Eisenhower a conservative president, despite the fact that he continued to adopt Roosevelt's economic policies. He did not get rid of any of them. Now, the liberals didn't like Eisenhower because he didn't continue it. Although there is the fact that he actually did. I mean, government control did get a little bit bigger. And even I think Henry Hazlitt called it a mini New Deal under Eisenhower. So it's not like he just didn't go as fast and hard as what the liberals wanted. So he didn't have anybody. I mean, the true conservatives didn't like what Eisenhower was doing, and the liberals didn't like what Eisenhower was doing. But so under Eisenhower, so going back to Roosevelt, I didn't mention this before when we talked about Roosevelt, but John Maynard Keynes was a big influence. So I'll jump ahead a little bit here. But so, of course, nowadays maybe you're familiar with sort of the economic, you know, battle that happens between like Austrian economics and, you know, Keynes versus the Austrian economists. Well, Keynes won out back in the 30s and 40s. You know, he's a big influence on Roosevelt. Keynes's economic philosophy was simply debauchery of the currency. You know, this was the, you know, massive inflation, printing lots of money. That is the way that you're going to stop depression. John Maynard Keynes was very much an atheist. His assumptions about economics was not rooted in Christianity at all. He was a avowed socialist. Singer says this about him. He says, very few Americans are aware that this economic policies had its origins in radical philosophy, which was and is necessarily anti-Christian in both content and outlook. And not only does this program of inflation and massive spending give an appearance of prosperity, but it also has an ideal way of redistributing the wealth of the nation according to the Marxist formula. So even though you're not redistributing wealth the way that Marx laid out, this is a way of sort of quietly and secretly going about a socialist program, is through this economic policy of massive inflation, government spending, business regulations by the federal government. These things were still happening under Eisenhower. Like I said, Hazlitt called Eisenhower's program the mini New Deal. But going back to what I said about this sort of separation, Singer says this. He's talking about the fact that you could be socially conservative, but then be economically liberal, and that there could be, you know, there's this separation here, and we still deal with it today. I mean, you know, all of our conservative presidents have been massive spenders, and they have not really railed back the government programs. Singer says this. He says that the new conservatism of this time in the 50s tried to distinguish between economic affairs on the one hand and human interests on the other. And this is a distinction without meaning, for they cannot be separated. And that really is true. I mean, you're not going to get true conservatism, you know, just by having a social, you know, conservative resurgence. And you see this problem even today, in issues of like abortion, you know, where we have politicians that sort of theory are against abortion, but certain policy, you know, like there's still, you know, there's government program, you know, they're not going out there and just completely ending it. You know, there's still a lot of financial gain to be had in all these government programs. And so you're not seeing a complete just destruction and wiping out of just sin, you know, because the government doesn't really do that. It's not their, and, you know, they have a lot invested. They have a lot of money to be had. Let's see here. Let me jump ahead a little bit. Okay, so at this time, you get the National Council of Churches. They are starting to... So, like I said, you know, they took a little bit of a break. They regrouped. They reorganized their council. And then they started teaming up with secular groups. And we talked about this before. We talked about how the social gospel had reached a point where the conservative Christians were the bad guys. You know, they were teaming up. The gospel, the true gospel, the kingdom of God was to be found in the secular sort of advancement of, you know, human rights or whatever, you know, whatever it may be. And so, you know, you have National Council of Churches in the late 50s, they start teaming up with like the National Education Society or Association. They start teaming up with labor organizations, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the League of Women Voters, and various other radical groups. And I didn't know, I mean, this would be an interesting thing to follow here, but Singer says that even by 1961, the major, he doesn't say much about it, but he says, he just drops this in there. He says the major television networks had also joined the crusade against the American heritage. So if you think about, if that's, you know, if that truly is true, and I kind of believe that, you think about how quickly that, you know, we get television in the homes of America and how quickly television became a force for liberal thought and philosophy. Eisenhower's soft conservatism did not appeal to the growing liberal society, so I mentioned this, and the shrinking population of true conservatives. And so what you get then is right after Eisenhower, you get the election of JFK, which was a very close election. It was not overwhelmingly, you know, pro, you know, JFK didn't win by a huge amount. But in JFK's administration, you get a tremendous emphasis on the drastic regulation of American businesses by the federal government. So as you're going back to Roosevelt and you see the emphases on what the government control, you know, gets, whether it was, you know, the New Deal and it's like TVA and those, you know, the Works Progress Associations and administrations. Now in JFK's administration, you're getting heavy regulation on American business. JFK, though, he's an interesting figure in history because he had a massive impact on society that you really can't he was not a good president. I mean, he didn't have much success. I mean, his presidency is known for the Bay of Pigs, the Berlin Crisis, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Like, his whole presidency was basically just barely trying to keep America out of a war with Russia. And of course, he's considered heroic, but really what it was such bad management of international affairs that it really was like America was hanging on a thread. You know, this is about the time when you start getting, you know, this is the Cold War and nukes and, you know, things are going to get really bad. And people were, you know, the kids in school were being taught how to, you know, prepare for attacks. And, you know, America really thought they were extremely vulnerable at the time. But, you know, then you have the assassination of JFK, which, you know, it sort of worked together. It was this interesting thing that happened where people were so enamored with the personality of JFK, and his assassination worked in the society in such a way that, to be honest, what JFK tried to do and was not very successful, Lyndon Johnson came in and was far more successful than JFK in establishing his politics and policies. And, I mean, Lyndon Johnson won in a massive landslide over Barry Goldwater during the 64 election. We think about, you know, if you were to ask the common person or look in your public school history books, you know, the greatest president's JFK, but JFK didn't do much. He was a personality that people did sort of fall in love with. And, of course, with his assassination, people empathized and sympathized with him and his wife and the family and just all, you know. But what that did is open the door to Lyndon Johnson and his what he called the Great Society, which is basically the New Deal, but it was ramped up. And it's really interesting. And honestly, there's a lot more where I would like to talk about sort of what happened during Lyndon Johnson's presidency and maybe how it even affects us today, because, you know, there's a lot in common between what FDR did with his New Deal and what Lyndon Johnson did with the Great Society. And all these presidents had their little, you know, their little catchphrase for what they were trying to do. But really, when you look back in history, it's the New Deal and the Great Society were the two big movements in policy and implementing more government on society. The difference is, though, is again, we talked about all the bad things that happened with the New Deal, but remember that the liberals at the time were still committed to this sort of inconsistent but very moral character. Remember, they were very much prohibition. They were very much pro-family at the time. And there was still a very conservative social outlook on society. And in the New Deal, in a way, even though we would very much disagree with how it was implemented, the point was to try to help people. So it was this, in the midst of Great Depression and the basically America hitting rock bottom, the New Deal was sort of this way to bring, you know, to get Americans jobs again, to save America. The Great Society, though, is happening in a time of great economic boom. You know, this is a time when there is plenty of opportunity in America. And what is going on socially at this time? You know, what would you, if you had to talk about the social atmosphere of the 60s, what would it be? I mean, you could probably name a couple of things, but what would you say would be the big, what was the 60s known for? Yes, the sexual revolution. I mean, so in the midst of a sexual revolution, and remember also Roosevelt, you know, he basically had the whole country behind him when we entered into World War II. I mean, the World War II was a war that everybody, especially as we were, you know, after the Pearl Harbor attacks, liberals, conservatives, everybody are pro joining into this war and you know, and going overseas. Vietnam was a completely different thing. So you have a strong anti-war sentiment. You have a sexual revolution going on. And Lyndon Johnson is not really trying to save America with his policies. What he's doing is he's trying to reshape America at this point. So the Great Society, the emphases, like it has always been with liberals, you know, we go back to abolition. Well, this time it is really it's racial equality and pulling people out of poverty is what the focus of his policies were. And of course, this was only government could do this. So government policies and legislation was enacted in order to change basically the scope of America, to get these things done, what Lyndon Johnson, he said he was not for redistribution of wealth, but I mean, he was for redistribution of wealth. And he even said that America can only be successful when there is a bigger pie, and that everybody has a more equal share of that pie. So, you know, in a way you could look at that and say, well, I don't want to take the rich people's money. I just want everybody to have more money. But, you know, how's that going to happen? You know, well, yeah, you just print money and you, you know, again, going back to the John Maynard Keynes view of economics. So the New Deal was a, you know, this is the way Singer sort of says it, is it was a pessimistic plan, whereas the Great Society was an optimistic, if you could call it that. I mean, it's not optimistic to us, but in terms of what they were trying to do, it was an optimistic plan for society. So I would like to maybe just talk about a little bit. I am determined at one point we're going to have a discussion. So I'm putting this away. And we have 10 minutes. So y'all join in. Let's talk about what we can learn from. And maybe we'll have one more of these, I think. And maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, he sort of ends at the Reagan era. And we can talk about some of that. And we can talk about the 80s. But honestly, that is, again, it's cyclical. And a lot of us are very familiar, lived through the 80s, are familiar with it. I don't know how much more we can, you know, getting into the details is going to help us. What I would like to talk about is what can we do today? Like, what are some things we can do today, even maybe if we just even focus as a church you know, in our own community here in Franklin or Middle Tennessee, what are some things we can do to sort of counter that? Because it really does feel like a snowball, where how are you going to get the snowball pushed back? Well, maybe the answer is not to push it back up the mountain or to, you know, so what is the answer? Like, what can we do as a society to sort of, counter what's going on? What do y'all think?
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that I feel like has been a theme throughout this whole thing is watching people identify oftentimes things that were wrong, things that they needed to be addressed, but then applying human solutions to them, and usually the wrong solutions, to address these issues rather than applying God's solutions from the Bible to these problems.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think...
Have you met man?
Yeah. That's for sure. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, we could just blanket talk about the fact, going all the way back to the Puritans, that the issues have been sin, you know, and man's depravity. But, you know, what are some things when you look at what has happened, especially, you know, the point of the book was a theological interpretation of American history. And one aspect of that is the influence of theology on the politics and on the policies in America and the direction America has gone. So how would you, looking at today's theology, how would you assess that? Like, what would you point to as the things that are greatly affecting the culture and the politics of America?
Individualism.
Still, yeah. Yeah, individualism. Explain, maybe.
I mentioned to somebody, I'm also reading a book called The Democratization mm-hmm. of American Christianity. And, boy, it's just striking how America veered off into this. You know, and some, occasionally, it usually starts out when you start reading about somebody's like, oh, yeah, where are you going? But it's this individualism, like the elevation of the individual and the conscience of the individual above the church and above anything else. And we still see that affecting today. You know, my conscience says that we need to be feeding the poor, just as an example. So let's implement socialism to feed the poor.
Right.
You know.
But it's interesting, though, you know, when the liberals are sort of countering this individualism, they understand that there is a desire, you know, we need community. I mean, that's at the basis of socialism and collectivism, is this understanding of not being an individual. You know, so it is interesting how liberals seem to understand that, you know, there is a problem with individualism, but what they do is they form community that is not biblical. You know, and even looking in modern, you know, think about the identity politics of the day. It really is. It's not. Now, while it is rooted in your own desire to be who you want to be, there is a desire to be a part of a community. I think if there was not that community there, you wouldn't see the sort of the gender and sexual misidentities that we see today, except that there is a community for them to be a part of. Anybody else got comments? I have a couple, but I'd like to hear. Yeah, that that is one reason why I I'm not completely without hope at this point, you know. Now, I don't understand, when you look at the big picture, like I said, I mean, you're going all the way back. Remember, we started in the 1600s with the Puritans. 1630, the Puritans come over. You know, this is 400 years now that we're looking at. 1620, even if you go back to the Pilgrims. So we're looking at a 400-year period where the ball started rolling downhill, or like I said earlier, there's a cyclical pattern, but it's definitely rolling in one particular direction. I don't know. I mean, like, can you, is education going to, and I completely agree with it. I think that's where it has to start. It has to start with worship. And it has to start with education and it has to start in the home. But what do you think? I mean, what would be the answer? Like, is the goal to push that ball back to the right, you know, to move it this way? Or is it to, what would it be? To just let it collapse and do something new or to completely... So, for instance, you know, like, if we talked a lot about economy, we talked a lot about money and how inflation has played a huge... It's not just, here's the social... You know, liberalism, and then here's economics over here, and it's this neutral thing. You know, inflation in itself is, in fact, been a liberal and anti-Christian, you know, aspect of our culture.
Just so, measures, or
right,
measures.
And you could apply it to, speaking of just weights and measures, you could apply it to, you know, the Supreme Court. You could apply it to all the branches of the government. You could apply it to programs, you know, you can apply it to good things like, you know, racism, where you want us, we don't, you know, all of us would agree, you know, racism is bad, but how do you go about fixing it, or how do you go, you know, it's the way things are done. And I would say that one thing I've thought about too, when we talk about individualism, you know, that really has had a massive effect. I mean, we believe that our worship, that the church has been given the keys, you know, like God has placed us here to influence the culture, to be a city on a hill. So if as the church goes, so society goes. So if the church has been known for extreme individualism, especially the faithful churches, and that's the problem, the liberal churches are not really churches. So you can't, I mean, they have had an impact, but it's an impact as they have gone away from the Bible. The problem that we see, though, is our brothers and sisters who are sincerely trying to be faithful to God, but are not doing the things that need to be done in society. I mean, they're both. I mean, obviously, but you know, there's problems on both sides here. I'm not trying to just brush off what the liberals are doing, but I'm just saying, when you think about individualism, though, and the fact that in our culture today, we are seeing people that say things like, oh, well, it should just be up to you. You know, you're like, your identity is what you want to be, or your sexual preference is whatever you want it to be, or, you know, whatever the issue may be. I mean, you know, those are the two big issues, but it really applies to anything, whether you're, you know, committing adultery, whether you want to, you know, sleep with your boyfriend or girlfriend, whatever it may be. It's a you issue that is private for you. And I think the church has influenced that, because if salvation is an individual thing, you know, it's a you thing, it's all about you, then eventually all the, you know, you're going, the church is going to sort of teach that to the next generations, and they're going to apply that to all things. Now, yes, your relationship with God is a personal thing, and so is your sexuality, you know, and so is your, you know, who you sleep with or whatever, you know, that those are things that are up to you, and nobody can judge you for it, or nobody can tell you what you can't do.
It's interesting. I'm sitting here parsing out the irony, because my first thought, as I'm in this book and hearing the stuff that you earlier sessions talked about, the individualism, but it's the irony is that now we have this collectivism from the left that's come in to fill the void. It's like the individualism led to selfishness. Selfishness led to, let's put our kids in school, we can go do whatever we want. And then all of a sudden you have this collectivism that has swooped in from the left that teaches the wrong things. That's up to the point that was made a minute ago about the schools filling that void, and is there anything to redeem there? And for years I thought, no, that's why we're Christian education, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So this past week we got to have a Zoom interview call with former Senator Jim DeMint.
Oh, really?
From South Carolina. And he made a lot of good points, but two that stood out in my mind was that there are people in Washington that honestly believe the government is an instrument of God's compassion. Mm-hmm. So that's a theological position.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And then the second point that I made that I thought was particularly telling was that the American War for Independence, the American Revolution, came after the First Great Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically was arguing, you know, without the First Great Awakening, you do not have the American War for Independence. I thought that was pretty fascinating. And then with that in mind, it is going to take another Reformation and revival of the church,
right,
to shift. And if we understand history working cyclically from tribe, kingdom, empire, we're at the end of the empire era for America.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you hear people saying go local,
right?
Local. Well, it's just true.
Yeah.
And I think that's where our focus has to be, is local.
Yeah, and we've talked about that a few times, about how we have such access to information that we really don't need access to. I mean, it's not that it's a bad, you know, it's not like, you know, you can use wisdom, but the fact is that I don't need all the information that I have access to now. And people get worried and upset and stressed out about things that they have no control over that really didn't, and they end up forsaking what is important locally or in their own households. Abe?
I think taking kind of the whole arcs of the book into account, one of the things that's important to do is to go back and see. There's no turning back the clock, which is one of the issues I have, you know, mm-hmm, when asked to define myself around politically. I mean, I have a problem with the term conservatism, because mm-hmm, what are you trying to conserve? Are you trying to conserve the way it was in the 1950s?
Yeah.
The 1830s or the 1770s. I mean, and just focusing on the issue of individualism, which I think is one of the, if not the central issue of our problem, part of the point of this book is that that really goes all the way back to the Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who, they should have known better, but through their institution of things like the Halfway Covenant and all that, they wrecked basically what the foundation for a truly covenantal understanding of the Christian faith lived out in a community, not faith being a matter of strictly an individual thing.
Right.
And so it's hard to, since that foundation was kind of ruined early on, now we're in the position where various people who want to identify the problem, Hillary Clinton, for instance, saying it takes a village. Well, there is some truth in that, but of course, the problem is
which village?
Which village?
There's nowhere to turn now except some kind of secular, phony, false version of what the church should be doing at center. And that's why, you know, I mean, take for instance our stand on something like Plato's Communion. I mean, that's why, and this ties into the idea of being local in your thinking, and also in terms of the local church. That's why some of those issues, I think, are important to us, and it's important to understand why we take that position. We want to, you know, the Christian faith is the engine for change in the culture, but it happens slowly. And part of it is us being able to look back over hundreds of years and say, you know, this is where we went wrong, and it was mostly our fault. And we need to try to correct that.
Yeah, and I think
we fought back just by picking up
right
where we are now and saying this is where things went wrong, and this is what we need to do in this small way that we can now to try to reestablish a better trajectory.
Well, and,
yeah.
And to that point, like I was listening to a podcast. It's been like 3 months ago now, but good brothers, Reformed Baptists, but good brothers, you know. And one of the things they were saying was, you know, this whole progressive, conservative, like, philosophy split, like, it's the wrong emphasis. Like, we should actually be the progressives. Not like, the left progressives, but, like, yes, conserving what needs to be conserved, but reforming and making progress on what needs to be reformed, from, like, Plato Communion.
For they should have a name for that, like, reformed or something.
Exactly. that was a good point.
Yeah, I think that's a good point too. Is one thing we have to remember. It's a slow, you know, it's a slow process. And Pete, and one of the aspects of liberal culture changing is this needs to be done now. We see something in society that appears wrong or seems wrong, and many times is wrong. We have to do something now to change it, rather than understand that maturity takes time. You know, so you look at a life, you know, it takes years, 40 years to, you know, to 30, 40 years to grow and mature and learn. And, you know, and life is a good example of how the Christian faith goes, you know, and how society should go. You know, God gave us the institution of marriage and family to sort of show us these things. And I do think it's interesting. One thing Singer said is that in the midst of the conservative resurgence under before, but also sort of at the end of Truman and into Eisenhower, the fact was is that people, these government plans had already been moving and going, and people were benefiting from them, and they did not want to give them up. And you look at that today, I mean, that's going to be a stumbling block. It's going to be a hard thing to overcome. You see this in the idea of, you know, like public education or something. Like, these are things that some people can't fathom. Even if they are very conservative in their understanding, you know, they're very, you know, anti-abortion, you know, they have very conservative values, they still have a hard time with the idea that government is not meant to, you know, take care of them. And so that's going to be another thing you have to overcome. And we're seeing that right now. I mean, but I do think that there's hope, because I have seen in the last decade where the majority of conservatives looked at the idea of homeschooling as a crazy, like, why would you do that? Like, why not just, you know, be a mission, you know, the public school is a mission field. Well, now they're starting to realize, okay. And so then, you know, and I see that in my own family. I mean, my wife and I, we were sort of the weirdos in the family. And now I would say almost all of my conservative family are on, you know, behind what we're doing. You know, it took a few years, but
my grandpa was offended when my parents took us out of. We never were in public school. We were in private school, but then they went a step further and we started homeschooling. My grandpa was offended. He's like, "Well, public school was good enough for you, but you know, to my dad, what's your problem?" By the time a few years before he passed, he was more definitely of, "Oh, yeah, no, this is not this. I see what you're doing." You know,
yeah.
For whatever, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. And you know, and we'll close. We're over time now, but I will say this too: as a church community, you know, we've come a long way in 10 years. You know, and I look back, and we have a diversity, and you know, those of us that were here 10 years ago, 12 years ago, with babies, are now sort of, you know, up here with grown kids going to college, and now we have other families that are here with little kids. And. And there's a capability of helping each other too, to realize that we all have these goals, that we all need to help one another, and we have capabilities to do that. You know, we can be the body. We can love one another in these different ways. Whereas, you know, there was a point in time where it just seemed, you know, we're all overwhelmed. But now it's you just see. But it took time. It really is just a. It takes time to do these things, and faithfulness and perseverance and pushing forward and not giving up. So, all right, well, let's break. Thank you.